All right, guys, what is up? Welcome back to Kingdom on the Road. I am excited about this week's conversation, but for an entirely different reason than episodes past. You guys know that this show was born out of a desire to expose Christians to other Christians in hopes of breaking down the echo chambers, breaking down walls and barriers, and showcasing that it's okay if we don't agree on everything. This week's guest, improv comic, coach, and podcaster Dave Ebert and I discuss a variety of different topics. And the truth is, while it's not necessarily displayed in the content of the episode, there are some points that we're not on the same page about. But the truth is, Dave is a guy that is honestly seeking God. The fundamentals are all sound. Those are the things that we are on the same page about. So everything else is conversation on top. So one thing that I pray is conveyed in this episode, and that you guys can walk away from having listened to these conversations, is the sense that we don't always need to agree on everything in order to be a part of the same family, be a part of the same kingdom. You know, at the end of the day, it's family, it's kingdom, it's brother. Regardless of whether or not you see eye to eye on everything. One last thing, one thing that we do discuss in this episode is mental health. If you or someone else you know is struggling with this, there are resources down in the episode description, including the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. Do not be afraid to reach out. So, all right, without further ado, let's get this show on the road. All right, guys, so I am excited for another great conversation this week. I want you guys to help me welcome improviser, actor, and host of the Gifts for Glory podcast, Dave Ebert. Dave, what's up, buddy? Thanks for joining us.
Hey, glad to be here, man. I appreciate coming on and just have the opportunity to chat. Give me an excuse to not be at my work computer for a few moments while I'm at home. So it's a win-win.
Why don't we go ahead and start off by telling everyone a bit about yourself, your ministry, what you've got going on?
Sure. The biggest thing, as you mentioned, is Gifts of Glory. It's my podcast. It's a weekly show that just this spring I switched over to a live video format. We broadcast on Facebook and YouTube live on Wednesday evenings. And we just bring on people that have interesting testimonies and also different things that they're doing in God's kingdom. We've had actors, comedians, authors, people, different walks of life. I just scheduled an interview for this summer with a lady that just opened up a basically a beauty shop that is specifically for women that have survived breast cancer and helping them with the different things that go along with mastectomies and things like that, trying to give them the feel of normalcy. So we're really looking forward to that conversation. So it's all about celebrating the gifts that God's given us for His glory, to just speak to non-believers and say, hey, there's more to being a Christian than church. And it's also to speak to believers to maybe inspire them to get up off the pew and get involved in the kingdom, because there's a billion different ways to serve God. Everybody has a gift, has a purpose, and we want you to be inspired that maybe if we have this lady that has a beauty shop, maybe you can be inspired like, well, I really like to do that. I would love to get involved with that. So Gifts for Glory is the primary. I also do improv. We have an improv team where we do just clean comedy. It's not about being biblical or making jokes about Joseph and Mary on their wedding night or whatever. It's just clean comedy that's accessible to everybody, but we do it for a purpose so that we can set the stage for the message of the gospel to go out. And I also teach improv as a way to help people in their ministry, or as a way to help them overcome trauma in their lives.
I've found since starting to have conversations with more and more people, this whole thing designed under the idea of exposing Christians to other Christians, that there's benefit on both sides of the fence when it comes to breaking down barriers and having authentic conversation. There's something for the unbeliever, but also the believer, maybe the person who has thought that the sum total of their faith journey is renting space on a pew once a week, and I'm not trying to downplay church or anything like that, but the kingdom is way more three-dimensional than one day a week.
Exactly. I mean, you look at the church when it was first born in the book of Acts. These people were meeting 7 days a week and twice on Sunday. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true, but you know, the church was not just about one person up there preaching. It was about fellowship, community, helping each other. And, you know, divisions in the church, not like splitting the church, but, you know, they created committees to serve the widows and orphans while the others were still teaching the word. So it's all about coming together and being, as Paul talks about, being the body, where there's different aspects. There's different ways to serve. There are hands and feet. There are eyes. There are mouths within the body of Christ. And sometimes there are butts, and you got to deal with a bunch of stuff. But
with God, you realize, no, there's a lot of space for things like spiritual formation, discipleship, equipping the saints, growing people for different things. Is every single person going to be the person at the front of the room as the pastor? No, but each one of us is uniquely created with unique skills and abilities that 100% can be used for the glory of God, you know?
Yeah, we're all, if you think about it, we're all Liam Neeson and Taken. We have a particular set of skills that make us a nightmare for people who worship Satan. and we will come, we will find you, and we will save you. Okay, maybe we won't do the saving, but yeah, that's Jesus' job. But yeah, we definitely have skills. We have abilities. And you brought up the equipping the saints. Pastors and teachers in front of a church, their job is to equip us in the pews, in the seats, to go out and do the work. They're doing their work by doing the teaching and the evangelizing. But it's our job to get up off the bench and get into the game, because if you think about what Jesus taught us, everything is an action. Follow, walk, pursue, chase, knock, seek. It's all action. There's nothing that Jesus said other than the Sabbath. There's nothing where he said, I just sit there and let somebody talk to you for a few hours and you'll be saved. No, he was very action-oriented. Go to the ends of the earth, because Jesus already knew that the world was round. You're never going to find the end of the earth. You might get back to where you started, but you just continue another revolution.
Right, right. If you look at the biggest, you know, example of our relationship with God here on earth, marriage. Well, talk about marriage. Most people who are married will say that love is an action word. It is a daily word, you know, more than just a feeling. It involves having to take action and doing different things. It's the same exact way with God. Our relationship with God has a participant role to it that is made for us.
Exactly. It's a participation. It's a relationship. It's walking with. It's us trying. It's not us trying to keep up with God. It's God slowing himself down so that we can walk with him. And it's so important that we realize that we have, you know, that purpose. We have that calling to do more, because when Jesus said, "You're going to do more," or "You're going to do greater things than me," he's saying that we're going to reach more people, because he ministered in about 100 square miles in his 3 years of active ministry. We have an entire globe to minister to. So that's where the greater comes in, is because we're going to reach greater numbers of people.
Right, right. So let's go ahead and jump into the story. How did you get to this point?
Lost a bet. No, I'm well, I was always somebody that liked to entertain and give people something to laugh at. As young as 2 years old, there's a picture of me at a pool in Lamont, Illinois. And they were having like a bodybuilding or like a swim tube contest. Something was going on. I don't remember. It was two. But something was happening there at the pool that my family was watching, that my mom and dad were watching, and I couldn't be shown up by these guys. So I was in front of my mom, dad, and their friends, doing my own little flexing, my own little posing, trying to steal the show. And you know, that was just like the earliest. And the only reason I remember that is because we had a Polaroid picture for those that that remember Polaroids. And that was just photo evidence that I always loved to be in front of people and entertain. So fast forward to high school. And in high school, I do different things. Like my dad was a Vietnam veteran, and so he contracted the side effects of the Agent Orange chemical. And he quickly faded from a very healthy 30-year-old to on disability by 40. And as he got older, and I got older, and in my teenage years, there's natural butting of heads during that time anyway. But when you have a father that is dealing with the loss of every skill set that he's had, he could no longer work with his hands. He was losing a lot of his cognitive abilities and sharpness, all because of the Agent Orange. So those all fed into a lot of tension in the home. And between that tension, natural teenage changes, also being a funny guy who also had really hopeless romantic ideals, and never really landing the girl in any situation in high school. You know, all that kind of added up to this, you know, series of letdowns, which led into a deep depression. And so in about my junior year in high school, I entered into this really dark place. And for many, many years, I was wrestling with the thought of suicide. I really wrestled with whether or not I had any worth, whether or not I had anything to offer, whether or not I should even be on this planet, you know, thinking I was a mistake, that, you know, just a million and one negative things, which are all the voices and the screams of Satan and the lies from the pit of hell. But they sound very convincing when you see, well, I've got nothing in my hands that can prove you wrong. As a sixth grader, I did accept Christ as my savior, but I wasn't discipled, because our church was more like, okay, we'll send our kids to summer camp, but we won't really disciple them. You know, they can come and sit quietly in church or sit in Sunday school, but the actual process of walking through what it means to be a follower of Christ, it wasn't there. So I had the seed planted because of summer church camp, but it was never watered. And I think that kind of fed into why I didn't have the ability to speak against the voices telling me, you know, you should end it. You should, you know, do this or do that. You know, your dad's got a lot of medicines he's taking. You know, one of those bottles could end your pain permanently. And so because we didn't have a strong faith, that fed into the fighting between my dad and I, that fed into the depression. And so this whole time, knowing that I'm not well, a lot of people who are not in a healthy state of mind, they become aware of it. I know that this isn't good, but yes. Then there's the shame. I don't want to tell anybody, so I wanted to cover it up. So I continue to be funny, the class clown, trying to entertain people, because I felt that, number one, if I could make you laugh, you wouldn't see inside what's going on here. And if I could make you laugh, I also am preventing you from feeling the same thing, which means that I have some value I'm offering the world. So if you're able to laugh, if I'm able to entertain you, make your life a little bit better, at least for that moment, then that could justify me living just that next day or that next week, because I contributed something positive. So my humor was always, or once high school happened, it was a defense mechanism. It was a cloaking mechanism. And that's where I found all my value, was in entertainment. I got into radio for the same reason. I got into pro wrestling for the same reason. It was all about entertaining and providing value through what I could do for people. If I told a joke that hurt somebody's feelings, or that just fell flat, or was just embarrassing, or if I had a match that went horrible and, you know, it was just an embarrassment to be out there, the one thing I was drawing value from was now no longer there. So that next week, until I had another chance to not redeem myself, you know, it was miserable. So that happened. That went through 1995, 96, somewhere like that, all the way to 2013 when I finally realized that God was had been tapping me on the shoulder for a long time. Because I was at this peak where I was starting to warm up to the idea of pursuing God, but at the same time I was wrestling with the thought of suicide. So I like to define it, or you know, illustrate it by saying I was on this mountaintop where if I go down the left side of the mountain, I'm going to take my life, or if I'm going to give my life, I go down the right side and give my life to God. And so that's what I ended up doing. One Saturday morning, I was walking to work. I was late. As usual, I was a procrastinator. But there just happened to be two kids from a local Bible college there. And there's no other reason for them to be there other than God had put it on their hearts to be there, because there wasn't a lot of witnessing opportunities for them there. There weren't a lot of people around. It was a very busy area, especially on Saturday. But they just happened to be there. And I didn't give them really an opportunity to pray for me or talk to me because I was late, and I kind of blew them off. Said, yeah, yeah, I'm a Christian. Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, I pray. Because they were like, hey, can we pray for you? I'm like, no, I got to get to work. But they handed me a tract, which is a basically like a little graphic comic book that's got a gospel message to it. So I took that and I went to work, came home. And it was then I started to realize, okay, God's tapping me on the shoulder. I need to turn around and seek him. So I started reading the Bible. I read the King James Version from Genesis to Numbers and Deuteronomy. And I was like, this is hard.
So yeah.
But at the same time, I started reading Rick Warren's book, Purpose Driven Life. And I realized that what I had been using as a defense mechanism, as a hiding mechanism, was actually what God wanted to use. Because I developed abilities to kind of read people and understand what they were going through because I was so busy trying to hide what I was going through. And I developed a sensitivity, and God's using that as a comedy for his purposes now. Because after pursuing him in early 2013, I left West Virginia, I came to Chicago, and started an improv ministry where, as I said, we just do clean comedy, something that everybody can relate to, everybody can come see. We don't get preachy, air quotes, from the stage, but it's just a way to come together and to enjoy something that we all can understand. Because one of the funniest things and the most successful part of improv is when people recognize quirks that they have themselves or that they know that exist in other people. It's not so much the wit of the funniest thing ever. It's the recognition of the humanity and the things that make us common. So doing improv as a ministry brings people together in a way that either, if there's no gospel message preached at a show that night, there's still ministry done because the light and joy of Christ is in the room with us. But if there is an opportunity, the comedy kind of plows the field and opens the door for people to receive something that the Lord might have to say to them. So that's where it all started.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, I think we kind of have this model in our head sometimes that, you know, reaching somebody for Christ means preaching at them or means reading the Bible at them or something along those lines. But, you know, in my own experience, I've seen through the power of hindsight that true discipleship happened in my life. True mentoring happened in my life over cups of coffee, over doing life together, mm-hmm. not just, you know, not from behind a pulpit. You know what I mean?
Right. Exactly. And that's how Jesus did. His greatest work as far as like discipling was in the relationships of walking with 12 men and the other people that were around and just doing life, showing them how to love, showing them how to preach truth in love, and then also showing them when it's right to get righteously angry at something. Mm-hmm. You know, he showed them and he walked the walk, he talked the talk. And I think that's what a lot of people, especially in the American church, miss. They think that just because I sit and listen, that I'm being discipled. But discipling happens in the smaller groups. It happens one-on-one or in small groups of four or six or eight, where there's levels of accountability, there's the ability to ask questions. And I never really got that until I moved to Chicago and joined a church. It was in life groups, and it was in, you know, hanging out with the pastor, hanging out with brothers and sisters, that it helped me grow on top of what I was doing on my own with reading scripture and doing devotionals and things like that. So the real discipleship, like I said, happens in person when there is no platform, but it's just people sitting over coffee or sitting around a coffee table and reading scripture or reading a Bible study or watching even a Christian movie. That's right. Where discipleship happens.
I've quietly had this prayer over the last year. With everything that's gone on, especially at the early stages when the actual buildings were all shut down and, you know, everybody's scrambling to figure out what Sunday morning is now going to look like and all of that. Well, when you strip away the building, when you strip away the routine, when you strip away the Sunday best and the pleasantries and all of that kind of stuff, I'm, again, not trying to minimize church, but for church that or for a lot of Christians that is church. And when you strip all of that away, what's that leave you with? That leaves you with God, and that's real awkward for some people. You know what I mean? When all of the other stuff is gone, now it's just you and God. And I've low key had this hope for specifically the American church, but I'm sure that there's flavors of this that will go that could be applicable all over the world. That some of that best foot forward Sunday best routine sort of thing will be sacrificed for getting back to doing life together, having intimacy and relationship with God. You know, that's one thing, that's one of the biggest things that I've learned since getting saved, is that we're not called to rules or moralism. We're not called to a routine and a checklist. We're called to the kingdom. We're called to relationship. And we're talking about an intimate relationship that looks like you are talking to your best friend standing next to you, not bowing your head and having to have a certain amount of these and thous in your prayer in order for to make enough to get up to God. That's not how that works.
Exactly. And you know, these and thous, and now in the American contemporary church, it's the word just Lord. It's not about the words, it's about relationship, like you said. Mm-hmm. And you know, my hope for the church has been that, number one, the test run of what happened with COVID and everything last year is that we do need to find more ways to do life together, to do ministry, mm-hmm. to be together. But also, we need to start preparing ourselves for those end times. When are we going to consistently buckle when, you know, when things get rough? And, you know, I don't want to get, you know, like into the you know, open versus closed debate, but I think that the church should be awake to the prospect of what's it, you know, at what point do we stop listening to the TV and we start being more of the church? Be more like the Chinese underground church, more like the Saudi Arabian underground church, where short of Jesus coming back, we're going to meet, we're going to be together, we're going to make sure that we know that our neighbor knows that we love them and we're going to worship with them. And again, that's not to get into the debate of what was right, what was wrong, but I hope that churches, especially leadership in churches, have at least gotten familiar with the concept of at what point do we stop listening to what everybody's saying and be set apart.
And, you know, I know that it's easy for that kind of topic to hit a stalling point, yeah, at, you know, open versus closed and politics and all of the other things that get thrown into that conversation, and the conversation just kind of peters out at that point because there's enough toxic sludge on top of it.
Sure.
Where, you know, it's more about, okay, we lived through a time in the last year that they were playing our song. if ever there was a time for the church to, I'm going to say, rise above, and it doesn't have to do with the building, it doesn't have to do whether or not you're open or closed on a Sunday morning, it has everything to do with, we lived through a time where thousands of people were dying a day. Tons of people were lost and damaged by this, not just physically, but emotionally, mentally. For every person that died, that's people that lost somebody as well, like the people that were left behind. And we had this opportunity to be the light, to be set apart.
Yeah.
You know, and I know it's almost like this joke of doing the whole Zoom thing and, you know, being able to not wear pants and doing the meeting and all that. And I understand it's played up for laughs. I get that. But at the end of the day, that should tell you something. If, you know, it might not be that first time that you feel it, it might not be the second or third, but eventually you're going to realize that getting in front of a computer screen for that same time that you would be going to go be with other believers, suddenly you're in this place where this thing that you feel like should be like, oh, it's so much easier for me to do this. I don't have to get in my car. I don't have to go anywhere. I don't do this. It becomes more burdensome. Mm-hmm. It becomes more of a chore to sit in front of the camera. Sort of thing. Like it's been marginalized to an extent where why even do it anymore? You know what I mean? That kind of thing. And I think if you look past the debates of it all to the layer underneath, to the big picture stuff, I think there's a lot of things that can be learned from, I'm going to say, predominantly failures over the last year from the church. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of successes, but I also think that, like you said, there were a lot of missed opportunities, which I think may be the grace of the this time of the COVID and the shutdowns and these things, is that the wise will see, wow, we missed an opportunity here. So when those end times come, when the persecution comes knocking at our door, because Americans have not yet really seen persecution. We've seen inconvenience.
Not in a large scale, no.
Not at all. And so I think that the wise church leaders and the wise within the church will see that this was kind of God saying, hey, this is the dress rehearsal. We want you to see where things are going to fall through. Be prepared. Have your, you know, have your lanterns gassed up and ready for when the bridegroom comes. And so I think that the only way that 2020 on into this first half of 2021 becomes a true failure in the church is if we don't learn, if we don't take this experience, find ways to still minister even when there's no building available. And one of the most interesting stats was Pew Research, which is not, you know, either biased right or left wing. They just produce results. They produce research. They released a study that the only group of people that showed an improvement in mental health in the last year were people who attended physical church, as far as Americans. Every other group, every other demographic went down.
Yeah.
But the only group that improved were people who attended physical church. As far as who they polled, like, did they talk to only Christians, or did they talk to Christians, Jews, Muslims combined? I'm not sure. But those that went to worship in 2020 physically, and I don't know if that means also drive-in or whatever it may be, but physical presence with other people, their mental health improved. So God knew what he was doing when he had the writer of Hebrews say, don't neglect the gathering. And I truly believe that God has spoken to different leaders different ways. I think that there are some pastors who have heard clearly from God and they haven't opened. And I also believe that there are churches that have heard clearly from God and they have opened. And we don't know God's reasoning, and there's nothing in Scripture that says that one way or the other is absolutely the only right way. I believe that there is scriptural evidence to either side. So I think that's where God is working in that, because there's certain reasons that certain people need to meet and certain reasons that some people don't need to meet. Higher elderly population churches, probably a good idea to go ahead and stay remote for a while. but still, again, opportunities. Find ways to go minister and be with those people in short doses, to where the comfort level is there so that they're not freaking out about the disease and the virus, but also the bigger virus of fear and loneliness can be trampled.
Right, right. And, you know, you hit a really good point. You know, it was once said to me that our relationship with God and the character of God is the simple part. It's us humans that complicate it.
Yeah.
And with the Bible is the only religious text. And trust me, I have gone 12 rounds with several of the predominant religious texts before becoming a Christian. The Bible is the only one that stands up. The Bible is the only one that you cannot find the thread to pull. And I believe that the Bible gives us an outline of very clear cut, hey, here's an example of this. Hey, this is how God was then, now, and forever, and so on and so forth. You know, it's very clear from Genesis all the way through to Revelation, the character of God and the way that we are called to operate. So for me, I've really tried to hone in on this idea that, you know, it is dynamic. It is, this whole life, this whole experience is dynamic. So any time that you boil down a subject to left or right, you know, black or white, or this or that, like two binary choices, when that usually means that you've missed something somewhere in between, you know what I mean? And, you know, I think that there's been a very big opportunity for people, for Christians to, you know, meet people where they are, and you know, regardless of whether or not that person's struggling with fear or not or what have you. I wanna pivot here, quick, sure. Back to mental illness. I think it's very telling that this past Sunday, in real time, we're recording this the week after Easter. Mm-hmm. And I attended my first corporate church gathering, I call them, in the last year. Namely, there's a lot of reasons for that. Our church shut down and it was a whole thing. But I met this group of believers, real small church in my hometown, that's trying to unchurchify the area, and getting a chance to, there was literally sub 20 people in the room. So it was not a big gathering, but it was a bunch of people that were together and authentic about just worshiping together in harmony. And that, to me, it was like this refreshing air in the room that just wasn't there for the last year. So I think, regardless of personal stance and stuff like that, I think it's important to pay attention to the effects that these things are having on people. You know what I mean? Like, it's very important to make note of that, because there's a reason for that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that you don't hear covered a lot is the number of people who enter into treatment for mental illness, or mm-hmm. the number of suicides over the last 12, 13 months because of the isolation and the fear and the worry and the lack of human connectedness. God designed us for community. There is no doubt about it. Because, yeah, we have our one-on-one relationship with the Lord, but he said, well, two or three are gathered in my name, he is there among them. He's encouraging us to be together in his name, even in as small as a group of two or three or less than 20 as your church meant, because we're designed for community, for accountability, for encouragement, for sharing the load, to take on the yoke of working the kingdom's farm. You know, for the harvest, we're not to save everybody by ourselves. We're to go out and work it together as a team. And that's what we're designed for. So, for my church, my wife and I ended up having to change churches because of different aspects with with the COVID and how it was being handled. And we were actually asked to leave because we were encouraging finding ways to still meet despite, you know, the fact the virus is still going on. We're like, hey, we can meet at least at this level because that's what everyone really said. And it got into this whole thing. So we were asked to leave because we were encouraging finding ways to move forward. So the church that we're at now, they started meeting drive-through services in last July. And then they started meeting at a farm outdoors in August, September. And then we got into October and they moved into a building. And our whole thing is come to your comfort level. If you want to wear a mask, if you want to wear two masks, if you want to wear two masks and a shield, come. But come and let's worship together. Because we believe that, you know, there have been people in our church that have had COVID. My wife and I are two of them. But we didn't catch it at service, and it wasn't an outbreak among the family there. It was just circumstances, because a virus is going to virus. There's, you know, we could have gotten it at Walmart. We could have gotten it at McDonald's. We could have gotten it at the drive-thru at Taco Bell. Who knows? But the thing is, we've been meeting, and people need that. People need to be together. People need to know that they're not in this alone. And it, again, it doesn't matter. If you want to wear a mask and you don't want to shake hands, you put on the red sticker saying, stop, you know, keep your distance. But if you're comfortable and, you know, maybe you're vaccinated, maybe you've had it and you've got the antibodies, put on the green sticker and then shake hands, do some hugging, be close. But whatever your comfort level is, there's so much value in being together and singing with one voice to our Lord. And so I applaud all churches that have been able to do it. And whenever you've been able to do it, it's important. And the thing that bothered me this whole time with churches being closed is every time there's been a national crisis, every time there's been a national tragedy, people will come back to church because they need a place of hope. But during this time, there was not a place to come for hope. It was watch it on TV, watch it on, you know, your computer or your mobile phone. Well, if you want to watch it live, maybe you have great attendance, you watch it every week. But a lot of people might watch it once or twice and like, well, I just catch a replay later. Then they might catch a replay. Then the next week is like, I don't have time for the replay. And then 4 weeks later, they've gotten absolutely no bread of life, no feeding from any source other than the news and Facebook. And so that's, again, where the church can learn. Let's find ways to still engage and meet people one-on-one, two-on-one, in small groups, no matter what the circumstances are.
I think mental illness is one of those things that a lot of times in the Christian community has been brushed under the rug. You know, pray it away, just have a better attitude. You know, it's just demon. I've heard it all when it comes to mental illness. And you know, the thing that I have to ask whenever presented with that is, okay, so we saw the fall of man, right? We saw the gradual corruption of the world throughout the biblical times and on into today. Mm-hmm. Why would you think, from a scientific point of view, that it's not possible for the chemical balance of a human brain to degrade from perfected state where we were created to in a perfect world to where it is now? It only makes common sense that it would, that the human brain would suffer from all kinds of very real external forces that we've seen happen within the world, and these things are real. You know what I mean? Mental illness is real. It's not just a state of mind. It's not just a prayer thing. I'm not limiting God. You know, I believe in a God that can do anything. I also believe in a God that gave us science to understand how the world works, you know?
And the Bible gives us two examples I can think of off the top of my head of mental illness and mental fatigue. Elijah, after seeing God do this great miracle with the prophets of Baal, he's like, man, God, just take me home. I'm done. But mm-hmm. God was like, take a nap. Here's a snack. You'll be fine. And then Paul, talking about despairing of life. You know, these are people who are stalwarts, who are like people that we would, for lack of a better term, idolize in the faith. That they suffered, they struggled with something that couldn't just be prayed away. It was a thorn in the flesh, if you will. And nobody walks up to a cancer patient who's got like lung cancer and says, well, if you just believe more, then that cancer will go away. Or if they had a broken leg, which you can actually see the evidence of, you don't just pray it away. You can pray for healing, sure. And, you know, sometimes God can and will choose to heal immediately upon a prayer. Other times there's a reason that the break takes time to heal. And it's the same thing with what goes on inside the brain. There are chemical imbalances. Our dependence on technology, the lights and the messaging and all this, it all affects the brain differently.
Right.
Because our attention spans as a society have shortened so immensely as a culture that it's a sign that our brains are being rewired. So I think the church is getting better at understanding or at least caring more about mental illness, but it still has a long way to go because nobody really feels confident, or very few people feel confident walking up at altar time to say, yeah, pastor, please pray for my mental health. I'm struggling with depression.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people feel that comfortable. And I think that we as a church, the universal body, need to recognize that if you are struggling with a mental illness, we want to pray for you because it's a battle that can easily be won by the enemy because you're not listening to that's the one constant voice you're hearing is that voice is saying that, you know, you're wrong, you're a mess up, you don't deserve to live, things like that. So I would really love for the church to make sure that the altar is welcoming for those with mental illnesses. And because you think about the pastors, several well-known pastors or several what we would consider successful pastors over the last 2 years have committed suicide. And it's because, number one, they probably didn't have anybody close enough to have seen the signs to really work, for them to just vomit what they're going through. And the other thing is the church probably would have made them feel shame that they're struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And those are my guesses. I don't know, because mental illness is different for everybody. Sometimes, no matter what help is offered, tragically, Rick Warren's son committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And it was well known that he had mental illness. And from all outside indications, Rick and Kay Warren, they were right there with their son and offering every bit of help that they could find. But unfortunately, sometimes the voice of the liar is a little bit too loud. That I do believe the church as a whole can do better to recognize mental illness as exact same power as a cancer, as a broken leg, as a tumor on the brain.
It would seem to me that there is this extent to, loving first, leading with love that neighbor, however you want to say it, that involves saying, okay, look, you and I don't have to process this information the same way. I may think something that you don't. You may not be in a state to be able to really, stand up for yourself against the lies and against the fear and against whatever else. But I'm still going to meet you where you're at. I'm not going to wag my finger at you and say, you need to get to this level. You need to get up to this point. And I think that in a world where information is at our fingertips, I think it's now becoming so evident that these things exist that you can't deny them anymore. I was talking to a different person on a previous episode of this season and about divorce and about how divorce, a lot of people who are divorced are thrown out because of translational inaccuracies and man-made additions. It's the same thing here. It's that same exact concept, and there's this level that has to happen where we stop with the need to be heard And we live out what the Bible says.
Yeah.
Mourn with those who mourn. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Regardless.
Yeah, you brought up divorce, and you know, unfortunately, divorce is rampant in the church. And unfortunately, we don't support the people that are devastated by it. First, we don't walk alongside the couples that are struggling so that we can maybe stave it off. But then once it happens, like you said, some people are asked, you know, maybe you shouldn't come back. Maybe, you know, because you're divorced now, it sets a bad example.
Right.
People who have gone through that pain and that trauma, whether it's divorce, mental illness, somebody in their family ODs, you know, whatever the trauma is, that's when the church needs to rally around and form a literal spiritual hedge of protection around this person, because they've gone through a trauma. And supporting somebody that's going through a divorce or going through whatever is not an endorsement, or it's not condoning whatever sin may have happened. It's condoning and supporting the person that's made in God's image, who is suffering, who is struggling. Like you said, mourn with those who mourn. So if you're mourning a death, a marriage, a disease, a lost job, or even mourning your own mistake that you committed a crime or whatever, the thing is, we have to rally around not to endorse any sin or malfeasance or whatever, but to endorse the person, to bring them to reconciliation. Because that's what Paul talked about, is, you know, you don't endorse what they're doing, but you put them in a place where you can restore the relationship. It's not about consequences. It's not about punishment. It's about restoration and reconciliation. And if we can be restored in relationship with each other and with God, then it's a victory. No matter how bad the loss was, it becomes a victory.
Yeah, that's the thing about the gospel message. It doesn't change depending on who it is that you're talking to. Pivoting back to your story, I would almost imagine that there has to be somewhat of a spiritual connection, if I'm making sense, when there's a whole room full of people and maybe Susie walked in with, you know, a bad day at work, or Jim walked in having just had a fight with his wife, or whatever the case may be. Everybody can maybe just let that down for a second and just laugh at something and just have a good time. That's a beautiful thing.
It truly is. And performing comedy or even teaching it, you get to see those things happen where somebody will come in and they'll be carrying the burdens of the world. It doesn't deny that the burdens exist. It doesn't deny that there is challenge and struggle. And when we do comedy, when people come to either watch us or they watch us online, it's not about being irreverent of what is going on, but it's realizing that there's a hope and that there's something greater than what we see directly in front of us. So when you get a group of 500 people together, even if none of them know one another, if they're complete strangers, there is a connection that happens when they all laugh together. It's almost as if they all realize that they have something in common with everybody else in the room, because they all found one thing funny, or found something funny, or a character that was enjoyable. So when you get a group of people laughing, it connects them because they're no longer alone. And when they're no longer alone, they can start to feel their walls come down. And then that's why humor is so valuable in witnessing or sharing your testimony or the gospel, is because if you make somebody laugh and you make a group of people laugh together, walls come down and they become vulnerable. And not in a way that you take advantage, but they become more able. They become that raw, tilled soil that you can start planting seeds in, and they'll take root. You making them laugh takes away the thorny soil, the rocky soil. You know, Jesus talked about the four different soils. You know, laughter can help till that to make it a good soil for the seeds to plant. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen it in shows, and one of the things that I'm most blessed to be able to do is I teach improv at Salt and Light Coalition, which is a group that works with women who have survived sex trafficking. So each year, like, there's two or three different cohorts is what they call it, that come through, and I teach improv as a way to improve their communication, improve their creativity, And also, one of the things that's kind of unstated, but I realize, is the fact that me, as a man, working with these women who've gone through literal hell on earth because of men, I get to have the opportunity to rebuild just a little bit of trust that not all men are the kind that hurt them for so many years. And at the end of the day, if nothing else happens, they get to laugh like kids for an hour a month. Right. And you know, you see these women come in, they're carrying the weight of the world on their shoulders, because when you come out of that lifestyle, there are physical scars, whether it's just the wrinkles or, you know, the crow's feet. Many of these women end up on drugs either because it's a way to control them or it's a way that they can cope. And so they carry some of those telltale scars, and people just dismiss them, thinking, oh, she's just another junkie, she's just another this. So they have trouble finding work. They have trouble finding places to live on their own. They have trouble building friendships because people automatically pigeonhole them. So they come in with all these burdens of not only have they lived through hell, but it's still continuing because they carry some of the battle marks. And so getting to see them literally crack up in the middle of a simple improv exercise where they come in with their arms crossed, the brow just saying, don't talk to me today. You see that, and then all of a sudden they play a little bit of Zip Zap Zop or Bippity Bippity Bop, and suddenly you just see it just fall off. Like, literally, it's like the Old Spice commercials that they have out now where the guy's like sitting on the couch and he puts it on and like the facade breaks off and he's in a race car. You see that same thing happen with these women, and it's such a blessing to be able to do that. And that's the power of comedy, and that's the gift that God's blessed me with.
It's really an amazing thing when you can see these skill sets that are redeemed. You know, I think we don't realize to what extent us as people can be redeemed. You know, just because we go from non-believer to believer doesn't mean that we suddenly are, you know, yes, we're a new person, but we are still a person that has come with all of our same experiences, all of our same skills, all of our same strengths, all of our same weaknesses. And being able to pivot and to be able to utilize that, you know, especially for somebody like you, who has that ridiculous background of going from wrestling to comedy, and then to be able to use that for the Lord is a very beautiful thing.
It is. And the one thing is, when I do improv and people know my background as a wrestler, they sometimes get afraid when I pick up a chair on stage. But you'd actually be surprised how much pro wrestling and, you know, improv comedy are so much alike. The clothes in improv comedy are usually looser fitting, but other than that, there's a lot of similarity.
So we like to end things off with some parting pearls of wisdom.
The first thing is that what you see in front of you is not all there is. What you see in front of you is what's temporary. You're only seeing the trailer. The actual movie happens when you're called home or when Christ returns. So don't judge eternity based on the trailer, because there's so much more for you, so much more that God intends for you. The idea of always keeping your eyes to the mountain is so pertinent, because when you keep your eyes on the mountain, where God is, you know, sitting there motioning, come, you start to realize that what is now at what used to be at your eye level is so unimportant. So keep your eyes on the mountain. Realize that we're just experiencing the trailer, and for many people, the trailer stinks. But let me tell you, the feature presentation is going to be amazing. So keep your eyes on the mountain and realize that this is just temporary. 10,000 years from now, no matter what you go through, 10,000 years from now, this life will feel like ripping off a Band-Aid. Yeah, I might grab a few hairs on the way off, but getting that Band-Aid off and getting to where we're going is going to be well worth it. And you do it 1,000 times just to get to where we're going.
All right, man. Well, it has been a blast. Thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much.